Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, I'm Gary Null, broadcasting video streaming live from our studios, New York City, and I welcome you. Today, we're going to talk about vitamin C stopping the growth of aggressive forms of cancer. Also, another article on vitamin C and how much you have to take before you get those great benefits, all from good peer-reviewed literature. Then we're going to take a look at the microbiota, that's the bacteria in your gut, and how it influences your health, University of Gothenburg. Then we're going to look at stressed out, most people are, meditation or some quiet time alone helps, but only if you find the time. Most people don't. Common antibiotics increase your risk of cardiac arrhythmias and cardiac death. This is an important study. We're also going to look at a public health issue, how the American opiate epidemic was started by just one pharmaceutical company. That is from Mike Mariani at Pacific Standard. And then 21 signs that Americans are the unhappiest people on the entire planet. Well, we'll discuss that. Also, we're going to look at 10 years on Iraqi lies and ruins as new evidence confirms the U.S. government used death squads to manufacture so-called civil war there. This is new information you have not been told on any site. We'll share it exclusively with you from Joe Quinn from Scott.net. Also, we're going to play you a clip of a CIA major asset, major person who worked for the CIA, and who was arrested, spent a year in jail, but was never charged, arrested under the Patriot Act, and then it was the Espionage Act that caused this person not to have a lawyer, not to see any evidence against them. But they were held in a virtual prison with no access to anyone for a year. Then the government let them go because they had no evidence that they did anything wrong. Why did this happen? Could it have had anything to do with the fact that this person was going to go before Congress and tell what they knew about the truth of the Iraq conflict and the fact that it didn't happen at all? How would this person know? Because she was a part of the effort in Iraq to prevent it from happening. Also today, how our government crackdown on whistleblowers betrays public trust. But normally that would all come first and our guests later, but today our guest comes first. We're going to continue with our series of conversations with remarkable minds, looking at the Trans-Pacific Partnership and other treaties, and what does it give to Wall Street and big investment houses? My guest is Dr. Michael Hudson. He is one of our nation's important economists and Wall Street financial analyst. He is currently the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. He was the chief economic policy advisor for Representative Dennis Kucinich, and he is a research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and also he has served as an advisor to the White House, the State Department, Defense Departments, at the Hudson Institute. He also has been a consultant and specialist on global economics of the United Nations. He's authored several books, including Killing the Host, which is his newest one, How Financial Parasites and Debt Bondage Destroy the Global Economy, which goes into great depth in explaining how the polarization of the 1% versus 99% emerged. His website is michael-hutchin.com. Nice to have you with us today, Michael.
It's good to be here. I should add that, you know, since the last time I was here, I've been appointed a full professor at Peking University in Beijing.
Well, congratulations. Ralph Nader has described the Trans-Pacific Partnership as the most brazen corporate power grab in American history. It was being crafted by the corporate elite while before Obama came into office, perhaps with the expectation that Hillary Clinton would have won the election, because the Clintons gave Wall Street and the corporatocracy the gifts of the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, CAFTA, and remove the Glass-Steagall Act. And Obama, on the other hand, ran on the false promise he would review and renegotiate our past trade agreements, which sent jobs overseas and eradicated American manufacturing. So far, most of what we hear about the TPP has focused upon patent laws and repression of the Internet, food safety and pharmaceutical drugs, and a continuation of promoting fossil fuels and removing trade barriers in favor of toxic products. But we don't hear anything about Wall Street's role. The huge investment banks and the larger financial commodities complexes. So would you take us through this shadow side of the agreement and negotiations, and what role has the finance sector played in the partnership and also the transatlantic free trade agreement, and how will Wall Street and speculative capitalism, the hedge funds, the equity partners, and the private commodities sector benefit if the other nations and Congress ratify it? The forum is yours.
Well, you're quite right to quote Ralph Nader in saying that this is an unprecedented power grab. It's such a large grab that I think most people have difficulty imagining just how basic it is. It basically abolishes government and it centralizes planning in the hands of Wall Street firms. It makes regulation of Wall Street and regulation of finance illegal under law. And under this act, Congress will lose its authority to regulate Wall Street or the corporate sector, lose its authority to regulate food safety, the government, whole concept of government is pushed aside, and no government that signs this agreement can make any taxation or regulation of any industry, whether it's Wall Street or pharmaceuticals, without compensating the industry for what it would have made if there wouldn't have been such taxation or regulation. In other words, Dodd-Frank and the regulations requiring banks to set aside more reserves for all of their derivatives, and 15 banks in America hold 90% or $9 trillion of derivatives, and all of this $9 trillion is all guaranteed by government. The Dodd-Frank law was rewritten without anybody knowing in Congress and added to the last Increasing the American Debt Act. The reason that Wall Street is behind all of this is it looks at every industry as a profit center. For instance, look at what it's done to public health. In Europe, we have single payer for public health, and it's very low cost. But Wall Street says, wait a minute, if we privatize the health profession, then we can financialize it and make a huge profit on that, and that's why most of the American health charges are going up. Same thing with education. In Europe, education is provided largely freely, but in America, Wall Street says, wait a minute, if we can begin to privatize education and charge for education, then we can make student loans and make over $1 trillion in student loan debt is now larger than the loans that banks make through credit cards. So privatizing education has created this huge business. If the government in America were to say, wait a minute, let's give free education, then the banks could, under the trade agreement, could sue the government and say, wait a minute, you've just lost us $1 trillion. You're going to have to pay a tax payer expense. And by the way, if your laws, there should be another collapse in derivative trade because you're regulating pollution or the use of oil, then there's going to be a huge collapse of the trillions of dollars of derivative trade, and the taxpayers will have to pay for that. So the idea is basically to end the whole concept of a mixed economy, to end the concept of governments either regulating monopolies or fining them or passing new rules. The classic example of this occurred with the in Australia when Australia tried to pass a health law saying on cigarettes you have to warn people that smoking is dangerous, and the Philip Morris, renamed Altria, sued and said, well, we would have made X amount of profits if you wouldn't have warned people against this. So all of your warning has diminished the market of smoking, and you have to pay us as if Australians have continued to increase smoking year after year after year. This is the kind of law that, first of all, it increased Philip Morris's stock value. And most of the stocks and the bonds and all of this are held by Wall Street on behalf of the 1%. So what this Trans-Pacific Agreement is has almost nothing to do with trade at all. It's a means for corporate economy and basically for Wall Street behind the corporate economy to sue governments and essentially to begin dismantling government and dismantling the whole regulatory system that's put in place over the last century. And that's so huge a power grab that most people can't believe it, especially because the press is saying, well, it's really not getting rid of government. It's really just a trade agreement when it has very little to do with trade at all.
I'd like you to address the idea that in a supportive Trans-Pacific Partnership, Obama claims that it would greatly reduce U.S. tariffs, and this in turn would reduce the cost of U.S. businesses trying to export to other countries and potentially create more jobs at home. Why should we be suspicious of this claim? And, for example, if countries lowered their currencies to compensate for the U.S. lower tariffs, then what would be the consequences? And is this really what the Trans-Pacific Partnership is about? You just now said that it was something altogether different based upon the type of judgments that could be leveled. These judgments, based upon more than 77,000 corporations that could take advantage of this treaty and more to come, and these judges are arbiters, there is no appeal. Not our Supreme Court, not our state courts, no governmental agency. So whatever their opinion is, after they have made their judgment, it is binding, and the United States would have to pay for it. Also, when you mention derivatives, my figure shows, and maybe I'm wrong on this, that the American banks, the five leading American banks, three of which of the banks you mentioned, such as J.P. Morgan and
Citicorp
and Chase, that they hold over $66 trillion in derivative positions. And also, if they fail, if their gambles go wrong, and you said they would have to be bailed out by the American consumer, well, that's six times more than the gross domestic product. So how in the world could that possibly happen? And would they have any access to our savings accounts in banks right now, based upon the bail-in principle that occurred 2 years ago when Cyprus banks bailed in and people lost over $100 billion? Your thoughts?
Well, you've asked three questions, and I should segregate them. First of all, regarding the derivatives, there are so many different figures around. Nobody really knows because the banks are not even required to report how many derivatives they have. The $10 billion referred to their exposure because they've hedged the derivatives on the theory that, well, if they've sold at one price, they get the right to rebuy a commodity or a bond at another price. But the question is whether their counterparties, the pension funds or the banks on the other end of this trade, can pay. So all that we can really say is trillions of dollars are enormous. It's unlikely that there will be, under current law, depositors will lose because the FDIC insures everybody. And Sheila Bair, the head of the FDIC, in 2008 said, wait a minute, we think we should take over Citibank. It's insolvent. It's the largest insolvent bank. It needs to borrow $120 billion just to survive. Let's close down Citibank. It has enough money that all of the insured depositors are going to be paid in full. No problem at all. The people will lose are the speculators, the stockholders, especially Saudi Arabia, that's bought very heavily into it, and the big depositors. But they should lose because they're in a reckless bank. So, no, the depositors won't won't lose if the banks go under. The question is whether the Federal Reserve is simply going to create money to compensate the banks for their bad gambles. The earlier question you pointed out, you began with talking about Obama saying that exporting more is going to help more jobs. This is junk economics. Somebody put this number into his hand, and you can be sure it's one of the lobbyists that are his major campaign contributors, and they all come from Wall Street. The fact is, what does America really have to export besides its agriculture and besides its raw materials and its monopoly goods? Other countries are not going to be reducing their tariffs against basically American manufacturers, because America can't afford to manufacture things, largely because we have to the workers have to pay so much money just for rent, just for the credit card debt, just for their student loan debt, and just for the rising prices, the wage withholding, that there's no way that a financialized economy like America can compete industrially with foreign countries. So Obama didn't say a word about any of that. And as you pointed out, if foreign countries all of a sudden were inundated by U.S. exports, their currency would go down, and that would compensate, and they'd just depreciate the currency, and it would be no effect whatsoever. So when you get Obama reading the script that's put in his hands by lobbyists, you get an idea of what's really happening. This is part of a orchestrated campaign, and the fact is that it's people like Ralph Nader and others that are speaking out, almost like voices in the darkness. I had difficulty. My book's available on Amazon, but all the major publishers that my agent submitted it to said, "Wait a minute, this is criticizing the Obama administration. This isn't really the line. We want a self-help book for people to make money off of the coming collapse. Can't you write a book on how, when America collapses, you can make money like John Paulson made money on betting against junk mortgages?" Well, that wasn't the aim of my book, and it's not the aim of, but it is the aim of most of the popular press that says, okay, America's changing, we're in a post-industrial economy now, forget exports, and forget American labor, basically. You can still make money by buying stocks in monopolies, and the monopolies are going to gain by this Trans-Pacific Agreement. They're going to gain because there's not going to be any longer any public regulation of monopolies. Companies can charge whatever they want. There's not going to be any warnings against bad health from, say, sugar, because if you put a warning on, you're going to have to pay the sugar interests just as much as if people had continued to buy sugar drinks at the same rate they have in the past. And as you point out, the kicker is when it comes to suing, you're not allowed to sue under American law. You're not allowed to sue in American courts. You get a court where the judges are appointed by the large corporations. And many of your listeners may have had problems with their bank loans or with their credit card. And there's a small print in the loans they sign saying, wait a minute, if you have a problem with your bank, you can't go to court under the law. You have to go to a referee. The referees are all appointed by the banks, and they know that if they ruled against the banks in favor of the customers or the debtor, they wouldn't be reappointed. So your listeners may have had bad experiences with this. This is the kind of kangaroo court that the Trans-Pacific Agreement sets up, and it essentially ends democracy. Now, that's such a huge power grab that people can't believe that something called a trade agreement really is end democracy and turn over central planning to Wall Street. But that's really what it turns out to be. And over the next year, before you have an election in this country, I think you're going to have more and more articles going into the what the agreement really means now that it's no longer secret, and now that what was negotiated in secrecy by the corporations without any intervention by congressmen or by politicians is now going to be available for everybody to see and everybody to, it'll be spelled out. And this is going to happen in every country over the next year.
Okay, I'm going to need some short answers on this. But I'm going to offer you several different points. You take the ones you would like to address. Hillary Clinton has given 44 separate documented speeches around the world on behalf of the State Department and the U.S. government, and hence Wall Street and other major corporate interests, supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Yet she cleverly, and I'm sure based upon the consultant, she said, well, they said, well, tell people that you're going to question the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And knowing the Clintons, and especially knowing people of that caliber, they will tell you whatever they feel they need to tell you in order to get your vote. But she has a long history of supporting Wall Street and these interests. Number two, we've been told that on Wall Street, that is the driver of our economy. And therefore, that justified when Hank Paulson, who at the time went before Congress and said, we have to bail out Wall Street. If we don't, the entire world economy will sink. And also Alan Greenspan said the same thing, and then Timothy Geithner, each one in succession, both the head of the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, and Ben Bernanke said the same thing. And yet when I look carefully at the statistics, what I find is something unusual, and this may help people in the audience for you to deconstruct it. Could you separate out the Wall Street economy, the money they make for themselves, versus how much of that actually impacts the average person, how many factories they build, how many jobs they create, how many projects they fund that would be meaningful to the American economy, versus saying that they're too big to fail, no matter what sins they commit, we can't jail them, we can't fail them, so they get bailed out. And I have a question. I'd like to know from you, what would happen if each one of these too-big-to-fail banks were taken through a structured bankruptcy, let all the investors, the speculators, and the stockholders lose the money? And I'd like you to address that so that the next time this collapse comes, and it is going to come, we don't go through the same identical scenario with the same cast of characters and the same compliant media, whether it's the Wall Street Journal or Fox or Kipling or the Changing Times or New York Times, all saying we need to get this bailout, need it now, otherwise America will fall off a cliff. Your thoughts?
Well, when the Federal Reserve or the Treasury or the President talks about the economy, what he means is Wall Street, and what he means is the 1%. And when Wall Street says we need to save the economy, it means we can save the 1%. And since the bailout in 2008, all of the growth in income in the American economy has gone to the 1%. It has not gone to the 99%. The 99% has had to spend its money paying off the debts that it ran up prior to 2008. And so we're in a debt deflation now. The reason the economy isn't growing is because the debts were not written down, because the banks were saved instead of the economy. And the banks make their money off the economy. The finance, insurance, and real estate sector, which basically is the Wall Street sector, makes its money by extracting rent and interest from the economy. And this, the money that they make, when banks make more money, and when the 1% get more dividends and interest, they don't spend it on goods and services. They don't buy the products of labor. They make more loans to get the 99% further in debt, or they make loans to companies for takeovers and to buy their own stock. And so they're essentially trying to increase, to bid up the price of the stocks and the price of the bonds and the price of real estate. And so in school, the Federal Reserve and the President talk as if somehow running more of a deficit will pump money into the economy if you give it to Wall Street. But it just gives it to Wall Street, and all of this $4 trillion that's been created in new money by the Federal Reserve has all been created for banks to spend on assets, on mortgages, on bonds and stocks, to increase the wealth of the 1%, but none of it not a single dollar has been spent, really, to increase the employment of labor, goods and services, or wages. So wages are stagnating. And the other day, there was a meeting at New York University, and I walked down 8th Street that used to be the active business street in the West Village, and half the stores are all boarded up. The bookstores have gone out of business. The other stores have gone out of business. They're all for rent signs. NYU has recently, I'm told, by people in University Place, have raised all the rents and forced more businesses to close. So you're having a closed-down economy. You're having a more and more desperate attempt by labor just to borrow to break even. You have student debt continuing to go up so that the students can't afford to qualify for mortgages and start a family and buy their own homes because they're having to repay the debt. So there hasn't been any recovery at all. Saving Wall Street has been at the expense of the economy, and that's what the politicians aren't talking about. They are talking about it in other countries. We just had an election in Portugal where the left opposing austerity came to power. In Greece, there's a general strike being planned against the austerity that's being imposed. But there's not an echo of this in the United States because people are told every day that the economy is Wall Street, not the economy is how people go to work and what they get paid for it.
Okay. Two final questions that are based upon my own personal observation. I have a friend who's an attorney specializing in visas. And he had a conversation with me recently, and he said this, that are you aware of how many people who have good educations, PhDs frequently, are willing to come into the United States from South Korea, India, other countries, and take the jobs of people who've worked long and diligently and ethically and honorably to get some seniority, to have a quality of life and standard of living, and now they're having to train the very people who are going to replace them at one-third, he said, one-third. So if you're making $90,000, someone's willing to come in and work for $30,000 because it's worse in their own countries. And I said, how big is the problem? He said, 8 million. 8 million Americans have lost their jobs over the last 10 years based upon the special visa program of bringing the bringing very motivated, highly educated, very competent people in. But then what do you do? Then I see the other side of it. As you know, I counsel a lot of people. And one of the questions I always ask people is what's happening at the personal level that may impact the physical level? Because you can't just talk with someone who's got ulcers without asking them how stressed they are. I'm finding in the last 5 years, probably 80% of the people I counsel are so stressed because they had a good quality of life, they lost their jobs, frequently by equity takeovers, companies being bought, their jobs taken away, or these visa programs, which gave more money to the companies a profit if you didn't have to pay all these highly skilled laborers. Now, and he said, now these people can't find work at the same level they did before. In fact, he said, Gary, take a look at the restaurant business. He said, are you aware how many people work in the restaurant business? I said, I was told it's somewhere between 9 and 13 million. He said, that's correct. He said, look at the upper figure. He said, now, what do you make the average person in a restaurant makes per hour? Then add in tips. They're only between $9 and $10. Try to live on that amount of money.
Yep.
And then ask yourself why those stores on 8th Street are closing. I was just on 8th Street myself and saw the same phenomenon. I walk down Broadway and I see how many stores, 27 stores between 89th Street and Lincoln Center, I just walked there yesterday, are closed up. Now, they'll get taken over by someone, but all the small mom and pops, they're gone. You know Saul Zabar, owns Zabar's?
Yep.
Okay, Saul's a good friend of mine for a long time, and almost every night he stops in and we have a juice together, and or on a regular basis. And we're walking down the street, and he's 86 years old, 87, and he says, knew those people. And then we come to one place, and he said, Gary, this used to be 12 stores. Now it's two. It's a drug store, and it's a mall store, where there were 12. And he said, remember when I was growing up, meaning when he was growing up in the 1930s and 40s, he said you'd walk down the street and you knew everyone. He yep. said now it's either a bank, it is a drugstore, or it's a mall store. Mom-and-pop stores, they can't afford the rent. And my brother, Stephen, has run the association as a volunteer director for decades. And he said just the other day, he said that 167,000 small businesses gone out of business in New York, representing millions of employees because landlords control the rent through and the leasing. For example, I have to pay my landlord's real estate taxes. Well, that's an extra $6,000 a month. That's above and beyond rent. And a landlord says, okay, your lease is up. I want $20,000 more on top of what you're paying already every month. How can you do that? So it's not difficult to see why we are eviscerating the small businessman. Final question. What would happen if we took the largest employer in the United States, which is not the federal government, as most think, or the Fortune 500 companies, as people mistakenly believe, is small businesses. And what if we gave them interest-free loans, 0.2%, same as Wall Street got from the Fed, and we gave them a year grace to pay back the first payment, and then opened up, in order to qualify for a loan, they had for every $1 million, they had to hire two employees at a living wage plus health benefits, so that brought people into the community. I did the math, and based upon how much we gave to Wall Street, we would be able to employ 12 million people with a living wage in the United States. Your thoughts on that?
Well, on principle, that would work well on paper. However, if you give the small businesses a loan, the first thing that's going to happen is your landlords are going to step in, and they're going to say, ah, now you have enough money to pay the increased rent that we're charging. So the question is, if you do give a subsidy to small business, how do you prevent this all from being paid to the landlords who are just going to try to grab it all? The problem is really, when you come down to it, absentee ownership. This occurs much more in New York City and the United States than it occurs in other countries. And as long as you have landlords able to say, you have to pay us everything that all the money you have over break even, or else we'll find somebody else who's willing to, they're willing to sit back and see all of these stores closed down. Somebody owns all these properties, and they've decided that they can make more money renting out to the big multinational firms than they can to the individual store owners. And that phenomenon, that kind of malstructuring of the economy, is so serious that most economists just throw up their hands, and most people say, well, what can you do with it? It would require a change in the tax law to subsidize businesses as opposed to real estate. And the real estate owners are able to do this because the banks are basically symbiotic with the real estate sector. The higher rents all mean that now somebody can buy this property from the existing landlord, and they can get a bigger loan against it, or the landlord can say, ah, now I've just raised your rent by $9,000 a month. Now I can go to the bank and say, this rent I have, I can borrow more money on the basis of it. So all of this increased rent that's being squeezed out of the mom-and-pop's businesses, and they're going out of business in Queens, where I live, too, in Forest Hills, where I live, all of this can now be capitalized into higher debt, and that's why real estate debt and commercial property in America has doubled in price between 2008 and today. It's been rising at about 11 to 12% per year. Now, just imagine, the housing prices have not gone up, but the commercial property rents have gone up and doubled. They fell from, let's say, 100% in September 2008. It went down to 60%. It lost 40% of the value, and now it's doubled up from 2009 up to today to 120% of what it was in the meltdown. So the landlord's property have been going up, mostly by the 1%. People's wages have not been going up. The ability to pay has not been going up. And the economy for the 99% have not been going up. So all of what you're describing is part of the war of the 1% against the 99%. This money that's been made by the 1% has all been used to lobby and to really buy congressmen and pay for the campaigns to the Republicans and to Hillary on the promise that, now we've made enough money to buy you. You work for us. Go fight for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because that's where we're really going to clean up. The class war is back in business.
Okay, Michael, thank you for being on and sharing these insights with us. I appreciate it.
It's always great to be on your show, Gary.
Dr. Michael Hudson, and his website is michael-hudson.com. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. For those of you who've just joined us, nice to have you with us. We're going to go to our health and nutrition segment now. My guest had to be on early because he had an appointment. So now let's go to what can allow us to live a longer and healthier life. And by the way, as bleak as that might seem, that's just the opening of it. Because what we have now in the world, we have a group of people who are just accumulating more and more and more profits. And they have no capacity to say enough is enough. So anything they can do to compromise the system, to co-opt a system, they're doing. I believe our entire political system today is a complete and total fraud. And I would never vote Democrat or Republican. Don't give a damn what personality they have. He's very presidential. She looks very good. What do I care what someone looks like or how they style their hair? I care about, are they going to be able to take back America, our Constitution? Tomorrow, I'm going to discuss this with our executive producer and scholar in residence, Richard Gale, and we're going to take a look at the comments of Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and the Republicans, and then I'll share a different perspective on it. I think you'll appreciate how radicalized the concepts need to be for us to take a step forward and how this mess. I'm still an optimist because I know how many people out there, millions of people out there, tens of millions of people, don't trust politicians, don't trust the bankers, don't trust corporate America, and for good reason. It's the people who still trust that are going to be hit hard. For those who are aware, I just had a meeting before we went on the air here today, a whole room filled with people who want to do homesteading. Architects, engineers, lawyers, people want to take the next step in their life and do something that will have a greater harmonizing with the reality of the future. For people who don't believe the future is going to be any different than the past, wow, they just don't understand how many economic, environmental, and social tsunamis are coming their way. Now, let's go to health. Vitamin C. I'm very big on vitamin C. I've written many articles on vitamin C. More importantly, I've done actual studies on vitamin C. And I knew Linus Pauling very well. And also Dr. Stone, who influenced Dr. Pauling. Vitamin C is probably the single most important nutrient that you make sure you get in your body every day. The more stress you're under, the more disease you have, the older you are, the more vitamin C. Get a good quality vitamin C, preferably one that you are buffering. And buffering means take it with a smoothie, take it with a protein shake. Protein is a great way of buffering it so that the ascorbic acid, when it hits the stomach, and the hydrochloric acid doesn't cause a hyperacidic reaction. If you're able to get it through the stomach into the intestine, then you're going to get a greater absorption. But also intravenous, where appropriate, is important as well. And I've seen nothing short of life-changing results in thousands of people with intravenous vitamin C. In fact, there was a time where I'm pretty confident, since I was in touch with all the other holistic doctors and centers in the country, that the Tri-State Healing Center was doing more intravenous work than anyone else on the planet. And so we kept meticulous records, and the physicians had, and these were all Orthodox physicians. There were no holistic physicians, and they were just blown away by what they saw. I give that because here's what Prevent Disease says, quote, high-dose vitamin C has been studied as a treatment for patients with cancer since the 1970s. It can completely shut down specific types of tumors. According to a new study from the Well Medical Center, and scientists could one day harness vitamin C to develop targeted treatments. Well, they have. Vitamin C has a broad-spectrum antioxidant function with the ability to protect cell structures and DNA from free radical damage. It is remarkably safe, even in enormously high doses. Compared to commonly used prescription drugs, side effects are virtually non-existent. No matter how high the concentration, vitamin C does not harm healthy cells. Yet, through an array of enzymatic and metabolic reactions, vitamin C has an impressive ability to protect and treat in a wide range of diseases, including cancer. And then it goes on to talk about the different types of cancer. And by the way, I've seen it work in all forms of cancer, stomach cancer, brain cancer, lung cancer, colorectal cancer, and leukemias. And they're referring to laboratory work here from studies on vitamin C from Harvard Medical School. The Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center found that high dose of vitamin C, roughly equivalent to the level found in 300 oranges, by the way, that would be about 30 milligrams per orange, 9,000 milligrams, impaired the growth of mutant colorectal tumors in cultured cells and mice. The findings could lead to the development of new natural treatments. Well, hello. Nice article, but you're 30 years behind. There's a lot of people been using it. In fact, Dr. Frederick Klenner was the first physician to use it large scale. His maximum was 50,000 milligrams, but he had great results with diabetics and cancer. And then it began to be used with pneumocystis screening pneumonia and Kaposi sarcoma with great results as well. So good to know that. And then there's another article here about vitamin C, and it again shows that in 1971, Pauling began collaborating with, quote, Scottish physician, who I also interviewed, Dr. Ewan Cameron, and they did a study of treating cancer patients with vitamin C, and they used intravenous vitamin C, and they had good results. So, vitamin C, how often? I believe it should be taken about 5 times a day. And always take it before you go to bed at night because it can help prevent a stroke or heart attack while you're sleeping. Take it with magnesium, about 800 to 1,000 milligrams. And take it with cayenne, and it can make a difference. Now, another study from the University of Gothenburg in the Netherlands shows, and this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell Metabolism, that when you're using the microbiota, that's the good bacteria, it can make a big difference in your overall health. And they did a study here trying to look at the blood sugar levels and the bacteria in people who had a natural high-grain diet versus those that had a refined-grain diet, like white bread versus whole-grain sprouted bread, or brown rice versus white rice, or coconut sugar versus white sugar. Big differences. And they found that the major difference was in the gut bacteria and the quality of the fibers. So by having good food, you have good bacteria, and hence it leads to good health. So it's that simple, but it's that important as well. And common antibiotics increase the risk of cardiac arrhythmias and cardiac death. This is from Sun Yat-sen University and published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. Quote, a group of commonly used antibiotics for bacterial infections like pneumonia or bronchitis and some sexually transmitted diseases are associated with a statistically significant increase in the risk of sudden cardiac death. According to a meta-analysis of 33 studies involving more than 20 million patients, published in the Journal of American College of Cardiology today. researchers from China analyzed data from studies conducted between 1966 and 2015, comparing patients treated with the antibiotics and those that did not have the antibiotics. And boy, what a difference. Wow. Okay, here's a couple of ideas. Antibiotics are one of nature's great achievements, and antibiotics have saved millions of lives. That is without dispute. It is the overuse of antibiotics that is the problem. For example, if you have the flu or if you have a cold, those are principally viral, and hence antibiotics won't work at all. And yet almost everyone, saying a physician, will get an antibiotic prescription for something that has absolutely no value. Well, you could say, well, that doesn't make any sense. And how common is that? Well, how about millions and millions of times a year? And that means that every time you take those antibiotics, even one single session of antibiotics is enough to really impair your immune system and destroy the good bacteria in your gut and adversely affect your health. So tomorrow, I'm going to share insights on an astounding number of medical procedures that have zero benefit. Worse, even do harm. And that means millions of American medical diagnoses and procedures and treatments are based upon questionable scientific evidence, and they're still used every day in the United States. Well, where did I get this information? Out of, you know, some magazine? No, I got it out of the Journal of the American Medical Association. So, why isn't then this peer review article, why isn't then this going to change the way medicine is practiced? The information in and of itself shows that much of what is done in medical procedures have no benefit and are actually harmful. Antibiotic prescription is just one of those. I'll deal with that on tomorrow's program. In the interim, here are some natural antibiotics, things you can take or apply to the skin. Colloidal silver, colloidal gold, manuka honey, wild oregano oil, grapeseed extract is good, but also the olive leaf extract is terrific, and bee propolis, pau d'arco, and echinacea, and astragalus, and vitamin C, and quercetin. That is what we should be using in our home natural medicine cabinets. It would make a big difference. Also tomorrow, how the American epidemic in opiate use. It was all started by one pharmaceutical company and one drug. So when I hear Bill O'Reilly and others railing against, you know, drug use, they're not talking about what the real big drug use is. And a lot of people taking heroin and methamphetamine and even marijuana, they're doing that because they were first addicted to a drug. One drug. I'll mention the drug, the epidemic of painkillers, and how that led to the street drugs that no one seems to be connecting the two to. That'll be on tomorrow's program. Right now, I want to play a clip. And this is a clip of a hearing, congressional hearing, where the head of the Senate, the most powerful person in the Senate, and one of the five most powerful people in America, Tom Daschle, had a discussion where he said specifically, and you will hear it with your own ears, that the President of the United States and the Vice President, Dick Cheney and George Bush, did not want him to do any investigation at all into 9/11. Why would the President and Vice President of all people not want to know exactly how and what 9/11 was about? And yet you'll hear this. And so therefore, any station or any of the people on MSNBC or Pacifica who mock and ridicule those who've done their homework and bring intelligent, reasoned, and scholarly reporting on the inconsistencies in the official version of 9/11, and you call them conspiratorial nuts and 9/11 truthers, well, they're wrong. And they should, in a free and open society, not be afraid to have free and open debate on the issue. If you're against the official version, you should have a forum to allow your point to be made. If you're for it and believe everyone else is wrong, then instead of censoring them and mocking them and trying to destroy their reputation, why not at least allow an opportunity for them to be heard? Here, then, are some of the comments directly unedited, and you hear exactly what I'm talking about.
There's a vote going on the Senate floor, and I may have to go back to the floor momentarily, but let me begin our briefing. I'm gravely concerned about the information provided us just yesterday that the president received a warning in August about the threat of hijackers by Osama bin Laden and his organization. We shouldn't jump to any conclusions. Clearly, there is a lot more to be learned before we can come to any final conclusion about all of the facts, but it clearly raises some very important questions that have to be asked and have to be answered. Why did it take 8 months for us to receive this information? And secondly, what specific actions were taken by the White House in response? I think two things need to be done quickly. First, I think the president should turn over the entire briefing that he was given to the Joint Bipartisan Intelligence Committee investigation today or tomorrow at the earliest possible convenience. And secondly, I think it is important that the president release the Phoenix FBI memorandum as soon as is possible. We need to get the facts, and the sooner we can get the facts, the sooner we will have all of the answers to the many, many questions that this report raises. We will be talking here in the Senate today. I'll be meeting with my colleagues throughout the day in an effort to decide what additional actions may be required, but certainly briefing the caucus will be an important part of the ongoing effort to be sure that everybody is given the information that they need to come to some conclusions.
Senator, in light of this story, was this a failure, 9/11 a failure of intelligence, or was it a failure to act on intelligence?
We don't know at this point. I think that is exactly why we need the intelligence briefing, why the intelligence briefing should be provided to the bipartisan intelligence investigation as quickly as possible.
Senator Daschle, it's also been reported by various members of the intelligence committees, at least the senior members, that they were aware of some of this information. Do you think that the committees did enough in response?
Well, I know this, that at least so far, all of the committee members I have talked to have said they were not given any of the information we're talking about here. There obviously is a series of events and a series of circumstances involving the FBI, involving the CIA, but especially involving the White House that that require a lot more thoughtful consideration prior to the time we can come to any conclusions. I'm disappointed that this information was not shared, and that's really the point. Why was it not provided to us, and why was it not shared with the general public for the last 8 months?
Probably because it's classified, right? I mean, this is a, you know, secret briefing.
Well, I think that the information prior to 9/11 was secret, I'm sure, but after the fact that these briefings occurred, that this information was available is something that I think should have been made available to the rest of the country.
Senator, you told us earlier this year that Vice President Cheney called you and asked you not to hold wide-ranging hearings and to limit the investigation to the Intelligence Committee. Looking back, why do you think he made that call? Do you think that he knew that the White House did know something and that they were trying to keep the investigation limited because they didn't want to look culpable at all?
Well, I'm not going to come to any conclusions. It is true that the Vice President has requested on several occasions that we not have an investigation into this issue.
Okay, you just heard it. And that was Tom Daschle, who at the time was the most powerful person in Congress because he was the Senate Majority Leader. He also sat on the Intelligence Committee. You heard what he said. He would also say it about President Bush. President Bush and Vice President Cheney called him repeatedly saying not to do this investigation and kept this information from them. You also heard him say at the very beginning that he had evidence that the White House knew in before 9/11 information that it didn't share with anyone. So then to criticize scholars, whistleblowers who have come forward with credible information and documentation about the government's knowledge beforehand, that where they could have interceded, they could have arrested these people, they could have stopped it. That is a legitimate course of discussion. To attack those people without having their knowledge or their research, their facts, simply because you believe that any discussion of 9/11 should be official discussion. That's like saying any discussion of vaccine should be official mandate the vaccine, and if anyone who challenges that is just a quack. Is that the same for psychiatric drugs? If you don't believe in a psychiatric approach, a pharmaceutical approach, you should be attacked. And that's where we've been dealing with medical fascism. We've been dealing with social fascism. We've been dealing with political fascism. It's time that we recognized it. More on this on tomorrow's program, where you'll hear from a former CIA operative about what happened in Iraq and how it could have all been prevented. And what did they do? They arrested her for wanting to tell the American public through Congress the truth. So what are they going to say, that somehow that is, we don't want to hear it? Well, some people may not want to hear it, but this audience does. Tomorrow, you'll hear that story. Thank you all for listening, and I hope that you have a very nice day.